Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from July 27, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Ratana Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches the folks of a town devastated by natural disaster and disease the true meaning of taking refuge in the Buddha, his Dhamma, and a well-focused Sangha. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. The Ratana Sutta, this is really a key sutta. It's one of my favorite suttas, but it also, it's clear direction on how to mindfully engage with the Buddhist teachings. Specifically seeing the teachings and the example of the Buddha's life as a true refuge, rather than escaping from something, a refuge from the world. When the Buddha describes his awakening, he would often say, I left the world behind. And that's been misinterpreted by some schools, thinking that it means that he awakened and he just vanished. And it simply means, and of course it doesn't, he spent 45 years teaching after he awakened, so he certainly didn't vanish. It simply means that he ceased being clinging to the world. He was no longer joined to the world or joined to dukkha, which is how he often described the problem of dukkha. We attach ourselves to dukkha through clinging to the objects and events and the people of the world. Leaving the world behind is something we've just done in meditation. That's an aspect of taking refuge. During our meditation, even if it's just for a few brief moments while we're mindful of our breath, we are taking refuge from the world. And as we develop the Dhamma itself, specifically the Eightfold Path, becomes that refuge from the world, even while we're deeply engaged in the world. Is that clear? That's true mindfulness. That's what, when we're holding in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path as a framework for our life, we're no longer clinging to or reacting to the things of the world, even though we're deeply and mindfully engaged in it. It's not an escape. It's not a type of emotional disengagement. It simply means we're not defining ourselves by what's occurring in the world as our life unfolds. The Ratana Sutta. Nearly all schools of Buddhism refer to the three jewels and taking refuge in them. The three jewels are also called the three refuges. Refuge is a place or state of mind that is a protection or a shelter from hardship or danger. Refuge is a place or state of mind that is a source of comfort and peace. And the three jewels certainly are. The three jewels are the Buddha, the Dhamma, his teachings, and the Sangha. In Buddhism, when one takes refuge, one is taking refuge in these precious jewels. The ritual of taking refuge is a formal and usually public statement of holding the strong intention to have the example of the Buddha and the teachings of the Dhamma be the framework for awakening, along with supporting and receiving the support of a community of Dhamma practitioners, our Sangha. We're so fortunate to have what's developed here in Frenchtown, a well-focused Sangha. The ceremony that I refer to, and it's slightly different in the different schools, and some schools really don't make a ceremony out of it, but at one time I was involved in the Kagyu lineage of the Tibetan school of Buddhism, and I took formal refuge, and it was just a beautiful ceremony over 3 days with some intricate teachings and intricate visualizations that I now find not all that helpful. But just the whole process and the ceremony around it was wonderful. This was up at a monastery up in Woodstock, New York, which itself was a beautiful place. And the following weekend is when I took my formal vows after making that commitment to take refuge. Since disavowed, but that's another story. The teaching known as the Jewel Discourse, or the Ratana Sutta, was given in the city of Visali at a time of widespread famine and spreading disease. There were many dead bodies as the conditions overwhelmed the ability to properly dispose of bodies. The local citizens sought out the Buddha's help, who was nearby in Rajagaha. The Buddha arrived in Visali a short time later with a large number of monks, including Ananda. Just before the Buddha's arrival, torrential rains helped the situation somewhat, by cleansing the landscape of rotting corpses and clearing the air and water. Pretty difficult visual there, isn't it? The Buddha presented this teaching to an entire city overcome by physical and emotional suffering. Prior to his presenting this discourse, he instructed his attending monks to walk through the city and do what they could to ease the physical suffering of the citizens, and to individually present this teaching. At the formal teaching, the Buddha then presented a way to bring true refuge from the stress and suffering of the world and to put an end to all dukkha. In Buddha's words, "May all beings assembled have peace of mind. May all beings assembled listen mindfully to these words. May you all radiate goodwill and loving kindness to all who offer help and understanding to you. Understand this, there is no more precious jewel, no more refuge, no more comfort than the Buddha. As woodland groves in the early heat of summer are crowned with blossoming flowers, so is the sublime Dhamma, leading to the calm and peace of nirvana, or awakening. The peerless and excellent awakened one, the teacher of true understanding, the teacher of the noble path, is the Buddha, the one who has awakened." My words. Here the Buddha is not teaching worship of himself. The Buddha often referred to himself as the Tathagata, which simply means the one who has gone forth, meaning the one who has left the world behind. The Buddha had gone forth from distraction and ignorance, stress and suffering, to well-concentrated wisdom. He liberated himself from clinging to all objects and views. Through his own effort, Siddhartha Gautama awakened to become a Buddha. The Buddha is here offering himself as the example of one going forth on the Eightfold Path in awakening. Taking refuge in the Buddha is understanding that all human beings can go forth from ignorance and attain wisdom and right understanding. There is great protection and comfort in understanding that liberation and freedom is possible for all human beings. It's one of the most important points of this whole teaching. The Buddha never separated himself from other people as presenting himself as anything extraordinary or as a god or possessing any special qualities. He never even referred to himself as a Buddha. That's an appellation that was given to him, which describes him accurately as an awakened human being. He always referred to himself as the Tathagata, sometimes as a great teacher, because he describes himself accurately that way too. But simply to make the point that I'm the one that figured out how to leave the world behind, and I can show you how to do it with this Dhamma. And that example is so important. The example that another human being has done what we're trying to do is gives us the kshanti, the skillful perseverance to continue. We know that another human being did it. There's no reason why we can't, especially when we have his teachings and we can take refuge in that. The Buddha continues. There is no more precious jewel than the teachings of the Buddha, the Dhamma. Understanding this brings true liberation and freedom. The Buddha, calm and mindful, has experienced the cessation of clinging and desire. The deathless state of nirvana has been attained. The Buddha teaches the noble eightfold path that unfailingly brings concentration, liberation, and freedom. There is no more precious jewel than the Dhamma. The Buddha, in my words, the Buddha is describing that there is a precious jewel in taking refuge in the path of liberation and freedom. In this setting, in Visali, the Buddha is teaching that once practical needs have been taken care of, to turn one's attention to being mindful of the teachings of the Buddha. And it's instruction also on how to develop the Dhamma while we still are engaged in taking responsibility for our physical needs in the world. We still have to go to work and put food on the table and pay the mortgage and put gas in the car and all the other things, take care of our children, interact with the world around us. Those are all important things. But we should also be mindful that our refuge is in the Dhamma. And when we can develop the Dhamma to the point where we can be mindfully engaged in the world without being joined to the world, without clinging to the world, then we will have attained what the Buddha describes as nirvana. It's not escape from the world. It's not reward in a future life or some kind of different plane of existence. It's right here, right now, in this very lifetime, in this moment, that we experience true refuge. And true refuge is an awakened human being, a fully mature human being. The Buddha continues, there is no more precious jewel than the Sangha. Understanding this brings true liberation and freedom. The virtuous ones who bring the Dhamma, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those with steadfast minds, free of clinging, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those that understand with wisdom the Four Noble Truths, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those that gain true insight and abandon self-delusion, doubt, and indulgence in meaningless rites and rituals, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those beyond despair and evil doings, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those whose understanding arises from the support of the Sangha, who can no longer conceal the truth from themselves, I love that line, no longer conceal the truth in themselves due to the Sangha, they are the precious jewel of the Sangha. And every single class that we have here, I see that take place, how in our, when we go around the room and we talk about our experiences and our insight, we are so supportive of each other in this Sangha. It's exactly how the Buddha laid it out, how it should work. And I even hear that now, and you know, you've heard me say this a few times, from online students and people that listen to our talks, how much they get out of the discussion of the Sangha, because it's what they're also going through and the questions that they have and the insights that they're coming to grapple with. You know, it's such an important part of it, and it really is remarkable. Those whose karma is extinguished, the future of no concern, with rebirth ending due to the support of the Sangha, this is the precious jewel of the Sangha. My words. The example of the Buddha's life, the teachings of the Buddha, the Dhamma, along with the support of the Sangha, provides refuge from suffering, from the suffering of distraction and ignorance arising from dukkha. Being mindful of these three jewels concentrates the mind to what is of utmost importance. Taking refuge in the three jewels is taking great comfort in understanding that awakening is possible for any human being. The example of the Buddha's life shows just that. There is great comfort in realizing that the way of liberation is a path accessible and integrated by anyone, the Eightfold Path. There is also great comfort in knowing that we do not engage in the path of liberation and freedom alone. The Buddha often said that the most important aspect of the practice was the Sangha. The support and commitment that we gain from each other often provides the encouragement and the strength to continue, even when difficult times interfere. Holding in mind the three jewels provides continual direction for one's mindfulness. Taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha also provides a framework for mindful expression of joy and freedom. That last line is something that we do hear almost every class. We talk about how fortunate we are to have found this Dhamma and find a way to develop it in our lives. I think, to me, you've all heard my story of studying in the different schools and getting more and more confused. When I finally came to the Buddhist teachings and understood what he was saying, and really how simple, but simple doesn't imply that it's always easy, but how simple and direct the teachings are, it was like I was just filled with a great feeling of how fortunate I am to have come across this teaching, but also that I have a mind that can understand this, and not that I have any kind of exceptional way of thinking, that I have a common human mind, and the Buddha taught a common Dhamma that any common human mind could take to and develop, including the mind that I have. How fortunate we are, especially if we're interested in this, that these teachings are still here in their pure form, and that we're able to develop them and achieve what the Buddha teaches, nirvana. A mind of lasting peace and calm, a mind free of clinging and craving, resting in equanimity, framed by the Dhamma. Excuse me. It really is the true jewel, the true refuge. And when we look at it that way, when we look at Dhamma practice as a refuge from the world, we develop our own enthusiasm for sitting when things might seem difficult. We understand that now for 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes or half an hour, I can take refuge from the world directly. And as we develop the Eightfold Path, we start developing that refuge that initially is only on our cushion, off our cushion. And we can surround ourselves with the framework of the Dhamma as refuge from our moment-by-moment life, no matter what's occurring. We can maintain that calm and peaceful mind. And that is expressed ultimately by the refuge of having developed right view, fully awakened right view. When the Buddha describes right view, he describes it this way. Right view understands, at a profound level, dukkha, understands stress. Right view has recognized and abandoned the cause of stress, craving, and clinging. Right view is an expression of awakening, the cessation of stress. Right view is a view that is framed by the Eightfold Path, fully awakened, fully mature right view. That's taking refuge in the Dhamma. That's the talk today. Any questions about this talk, and then we'll go around the room. Okay. Jean, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. I had quite an interesting experience that I have, a lot of some physical problems, and yesterday I decided to go back and try a meditation that I have. It's called Alpha. I don't know if you've heard of it. It actually is supposed to bring the two hemispheres together, and it's just Tibetan bells and things like that. But it never had that big effect on me. When I did it yesterday, I could actually feel where it was in my head. And it was as if there were connections going back and forth. It was an amazing experience. And my blood pressure and my heart rate went way down. And I had so much energy that I ended up going to the grocery store in New Hope at, 9:30 and got home at 11:30 and still felt, all energized. And it was just a kind of amazing experience. It was a combination of acupuncture with Matt and this session on Tuesday night. But anyway, it was amazing. I feel like I'm just kind of being bombarded from a lot of directions with things that are helpful. It's very nice. Yeah. After a long slog through some not so fun things.
Well, I'm glad you hear that. There's a word for that. I wish I could think of it. For balancing the hemispheres of the brain. But it's a very powerful technique.
It's amazing. I mean, nobody told me that before. And so I didn't really get that when I was using it before. I was just kind of using it as a meditation. But when I had that knowledge of what the purpose of it's like hemispheric something or other.
That's the word. Hemisync.
Hemisync,
yeah.
So this is it. I was blown away by it. So anyway, that's my adventure.
There's a lot of research. There's actually a lot of recordings of tones that are designed to do that.
That's what this is.
Yeah, and
it's
really
amazing.
What they found.
There's also a theta, but that one is much harder. I mean, I don't know what the purpose of that one is, but I just love this alpha one.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're here tonight.
If anyone wants a copy, I can send it to them.
Thank you. Kevin, good to see you.
See you, Kevin. I think that sutta is such a beautiful sutta. So
it is.
It's so perfect. And it is simple. It's so simple, but and so difficult. We can understand it or maybe contemplate it on our cushions, and then you get thrown back into life.
Okay.
You think, I'll be able to maintain this, during my waking life or my normal life, and it just sucks you in, and dukkha does take over. Yeah. But it's nice that we can keep coming back. Coming back here, coming back to our meditation twice a day, once a day, however much we do it.
Yeah, and see it as just that. It's a true refuge, however much we can do it and be mindful of it. That mindfulness of the Dhamma off our cushion really is a refuge. Yeah, I know you've experienced it. And it's in the world we live in, it's nearly impossible to do it all the time up until a point. But we continue. It's much easier, I always say, it's much easier to develop the Dhamma in a monastery. But that doesn't mean you can't do it. And many people awakened during the Buddha's lifetime that weren't part of his monastery, part of his Sangha. In fact, if it wasn't for that, for those other folks awakening, the Buddhist teachings probably wouldn't have persevered, because it was because of people that were still involved in the world and became benefactors of the Sangha, of the first Sangha, that it was able to continue. Glad you're here tonight. Isaiah, good to see you tonight. How was your meditation? I know you came in.
It was
right. Ah, good.
You know, my brain is always, you know, getting this thing.
We all, that's what we all talk about. So I'm glad you made it tonight. Hang on, I want to get you a copy of the new book before you leave. So it's good to see you tonight. David, how are you? It's good to see you.
Things have continued this week, but no uptick in time spent, unfortunately. Mornings have gotten unusually busy. I'm not discouraged. Although I did have a question about the sutta you're referring to.
Please.
And that would be the portion where Siddhartha is now speaking to the crowd, and he's getting ready to tell them about the three jewels, the three things in which they can take refuge.
Yep.
And the first one, the phrase is the Buddha. So is he speaking to the crowd, using the term Buddha towards himself?
Oh, that's a good question.
My impression was he never did.
He's,
is this a translation issue?
I think that's what it is. And so I guess I have to admit that I misspoke, that he never referred to himself in the Buddha as a Buddha, except in the context he's saying, take refuge in the fact that a human being has awakened, using himself as the example. So maybe a more clear way of saying it is he never held himself up as anything special because he awakened, simply that I did it, you can do it. Take refuge in the fact that a human being has awakened.
But as a semi-historical representation of something that happened, I was having trouble visualizing him standing there saying, well, take refuge in Buddha. Wait a minute, you don't refer to yourself that way. So, okay.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's a really good question, too. See, he's holding himself up as an example of a commonly uncommon human being, someone who, if I can do it, you can do it. You know, take refuge in the fact that I've done this, you know, that I've awakened. And then he immediately goes into and take refuge in the fact that here's my teaching.
That it's possible.
It's so important to recognize that, not just in reference to the sutta, in our own minds, that it is possible to do this, to awaken. It's often presented, one of the difficulties I had, you know, for example, just in the Tibetan schools, is that it takes endless lifetimes to awaken. Well, it might, because there's not a lot of the Dhamma left in that school. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm not putting it down. I don't know. After many years, I still felt like there was no real direction. When I came to what the Buddha taught, and this is one of the first suttas that I read, I realized there is direction. There's a definite strategy towards awakening. It's not something vague, and it's not something that if I just act in a certain way, it'll be imposed on me. These are the things that I do. And that's what the Dhamma means. It's the truth of the path to awakening. Do these things, and you can gain exactly what I gained. And in the Nagara Sutta, Nagara, N-A-G-A-R-A, the Buddha describes the struggles that he had within his own mind, but then how he awakened. And he relates it directly to the Eightfold Path. So he says, you know, look at the troubles I had. I did it, and here you can do it. And we have the benefit, we have a benefit that he didn't have. He did not have a supportive Sangha around him. He did do it all on his own. He would refer to himself sometimes as the rightly self-awakened one. I did it. Poor guy. You know, we're lucky. We're fortunate. We have his teachings in front of us, and we have the support of the Sangha. And yet many of us still find difficulty in doing it, don't we? Well, thank you for bringing that up. That's a great point. Tracy, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Good to be here. My practice is continuing to be a challenge, but I have found certainly, as Kevin said, when coming here, it's almost like regrounding myself.
Yeah.
And even though I haven't gotten my practice where I like to, and I trust one day I will, you know, the benefits from coming here, Sangha, and I feel the, you know, the calm and peaceful feeling when, you know, some of the stuff going on that's fairly frustrating and distressing at work, but I feel like I'm really benefiting when I have that, you know, calm and peaceful feeling.
So. Thank you. I mean, the Sangha really is a true refuge. I feel that way. I mean, I've been meditating for over 30 years, maybe 36 years. I still feel so connected to the Sangha. So, you know, it brings such sublime peace even to me.
It's an energy.
It certainly is.
It comes from the group.
It does. That's why I'll keep saying we're so fortunate what's developed here. And the individual group Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday are different in some ways, but all developing the Dhamma in a well-focused way. And that really is remarkable, too. Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin, not why he was the Buddha's cousin his whole life, and his attendant for the last 25 years of the Buddha's life, asked the Buddha one day, expecting this great mystical answer. He said, cuz. What is the most important part of your teachings, the most important part of your Dhamma? And the Buddha said, Ananda, the Sangha is the most important part of the Dhamma. We can't do it alone. And this is coming from a guy that did it alone.
Mm-hmm.
But he understood that. One of the first things the Buddha did as the Sangha started forming, this is very, when there was, you know, 6, 7, 8 folks, is start developing rules called the Vinaya for how the Sangha should interact. And one of the first things, one of the first rules, when gathered together as a Sangha, speak of the Dhamma. Keep your focus on the Dhamma. And that doesn't mean that 24/7, but when you come together as a Sangha, as a group, you stay focused on the Dhamma. Those rules are called the Vinaya, the first book of the Pali Canon, the Vinaya Pitaka, which has grown to be a pretty big book. And it's interesting in the way that it developed because it gives you a lot of historical background into that. We cannot do it alone. I don't know too many meditation practitioners that were ever successful with a solitary practice. In fact, I can honestly say I haven't met one. That doesn't mean that they're not many, but I haven't met one yet. Even people that were famous for their solitary practice that spent years in a cave, Jitsuna Palma is one who comes to mind. She spent 12 years in a cave by herself meditating. Even when she finally got done with that practice, she said that coming off the mountain, out of the cave, into society was another aspect of developing her understanding that she couldn't have had in the cave.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Merton was another one who said he spent 10 years meditating, a Christian background, and achieved some great levels of understanding. But he said he came down off the mountain because he realized that his understanding that he had developed up on the mountain, removed from the world, in his words, were it was meaningless if he couldn't take it into the marketplace. What good is it if it's just an isolated, solitary practice? Mm-hmm. But taking refuge in our practice and in our Sangha is so important. We can't do it alone. We're fortunate to have what we have. Deb, good to see you.
Good to see you too, John. Good to meet everybody on the Thursday night Sangha.
Yeah.
So I think, I remember this subject from one of the Saturday morning classes, and I remember liking it then, and it's very encouraging.
Yeah.
And positive, very positive feeling that I get from it, and I feel like I took it in at a different level this time, so that was nice to hear it again. And part of me is skeptical about, you know, the way he describes the individual or the Sangha and who's in the Sangha. It's like lab or Miko's cat criteria. You know? It's like, wow, you know? So hopefully, I guess that's something to move towards, you know, to be what he's describing as a Sangha member, you know.
Yeah, so I don't just say things. I think
what?
You know that about me.
What?
I don't just say things to make people feel good. I think you know that about me. You bring a lot to the Sangha, Deb. Your shares are, and you know that, they're helpful to everyone. You know, and that's how a Sangha should work, and that's how this Sangha does work. So thank you, you know, for your contributions. It's so important.
So anyway, I'm just hoping that, you know, I feel like the Sangha helps me grow.
Yeah.
It's been really valuable, and I love that it's one of the gems. You just see it shining. You know?
Yeah.
So it's been positive. My practice is pretty good, like I've always said, because of my work schedule, it's hard for me to do it a second time in the day, but that's part of why, since I could come tonight, I came tonight, so I'm getting a second time in the day.
Good for you.
That's really nice.
Yeah. That joyful enthusiasm you have goes a long way, too. You know? So, this Sangha has been so important to me. Even in the development, or I should say, especially in the development of the new book, when the book was nearly complete on our retreat, which was the middle of May, wasn't quite, but I printed it anyway because I wanted to have it on retreat. And on retreat, the discussions were so skillful and interesting that I realized that I needed to put a little bit more information about becoming. What does it really mean? The name of the book is Becoming Buddha, Becoming Awakened. And that led to the inclusion of a few more suttas to explain that better than I had up until that point. And then that led to inclusions of about 6 more suttas as the book developed, all based on the discussions of our Sangha up on retreat. And then I can say that the book itself is mostly a result of questions and some, I don't want to use the word, and confusions that have arisen during teaching in the last, I think I've been teaching 6 or 7 years. In other words, having this seat has been so beneficial in developing my own understanding. It's one thing to understand the Buddhist teachings on your own. It's a little bit different when you have to explain it in a way that you hope is useful. You know, and I hope I do that. You know, I hope I explain these things in a way that are useful to people. And that has led to what I hope is a book that is useful for everyone. So I guess what I'm saying is that the Sangha that we have here is really represented in the new book. So, and again, I hear that all the time from online students. The discussions that they listen to are so helpful to them, to their own development. We don't do it alone. So, any other questions or comments? I can't think of any announcements. So, and a few times I know our retreat is coming up in October. There's info online. There's a flyer out there. If you're going to join us, the sooner you sign up, the better it is for me and my logistical stuff. We'll close with the Metta Sutta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta means goodwill or loving kindness. Metta is an expression, an ongoing expression of an awakened human being, and for those of us aspiring towards awakening. These are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, May all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
So that's the fourth jewel.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.